This episode is brought to you by Uptown Beer Society, a craft beer gang dedicated to making memorable collaborations with New York City brands and breweries owned by people of color. Learn more on Instagram at Uptown Beer Society.
This week on Meetin' 3, we bring you stories about how Gen Z is different from their millennial predecessors through the lens of food.
My knowledge of alcohol didn't really come from like Bud Light commercials or like Project X.
Yeah, that's my gripe with the platform as well, is that all these DIY videos, cooking videos, they're 20 seconds.
What's one food item from your childhood that you wish you could have today? Dunkaroos, because they don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Although, the Dunkaroos Twitter was activated again a year ago, so it's only a matter of time. They've tweeted a couple times, it's pretty hype.
Listen to Meetin' 3, HRN's food news and storytelling roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch. Valerie is not with us today, but we do have an amazing guest to introduce you to. Aria Abraham is the founder and chef of Aria's Malaysian Kitchen. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Ethan. I'm so happy to be here.
So let's just start with an introduction. Who are you and what does your company do?
Okay, my name is Aria Abraham. I was born and raised in Malaysia, and now I live in Brooklyn, and I run a company called Aria's Malaysian Kitchen. We make four Malaysian products in jars, two a spicy chili paste called sambal, and two are sweet coconut jams that I grew up eating on toast as a child, and that's what we do.
How did you get started? You didn't come from a food background. You came from a background in music and media. So what was tell us about the turning point. How did you go from that previous career to deciding that you wanted to start this company?
Okay, so I had worked in music for TV commercials, which we called jingles, for about 15 years. And I was single when I started working in that industry and had grown accustomed to giving my entire life to my career. And it was a fun career, so I never begrudged giving my blood, sweat, tears, and 24 hours of every day to it. But then I had a baby. I was later in life, I was in my early 40s when I had my child, and I found I just couldn't give myself 100% to that endeavor anymore. And I found myself begrudging all the time that I gave to my clients and to my projects and all the time that it took me away from my daughter. So this was 2009, 2010, right? And we had lots of clients who needed a lot of hand-holding and a lot of their social life. Our social lives were wrapped up in the industry, in the business. We worked together in the daytime, making music in the studio. In the evenings, we partied together. In the weekends, we partied together. And one day, one of my young clients said to me, "Hey, I'm turning 30. I want to go take a pole dancing class. Will you come with me?" And I just couldn't say no. And so I said, "All right, let's go pole dancing." And she said, "Bring 6-inch heels." Now, if you know me, I'm all about comfort. 6-inch heels and me don't go well together at all. But I got my 6-inch heels and I showed up at the class, and I'm walking into class and thinking, there's nothing I want to do less right now than swing around a pole in 6-inch heels, wearing practically nothing. When I have this beautiful baby at home and all I want to do is be with her, I'm missing this whole evening with her. And so I started to pull away from that career and I didn't know what to do. What else could I do? I've been a musician my whole entire life. It's all I knew. It really was all I knew. And so I started casting about to find something else to do. And one day my husband said, do food. And I said, "What? What do you mean?" And he said, "You've cooked your whole entire life," which is true. I learned to cook in my mom's kitchen from the time I was old enough to wash rice. And coming to America for college, I learned how to cook all the dishes in Malaysia from Malaysia that I missed and craved and wanted to share with the people that I knew and loved. And he said, you cook everywhere you go, you cook. It's true. If I come to your house, I'm bringing my spices and my ingredients and I'm cooking in your kitchen. It's one of my favorite things to do and I've done it this whole entire time that I've been in this country. He said, you cook and what you make, nobody's ever heard of or seen. And he was right. Back then, it was 92 when I came to the U.S. Nobody knew what Malaysian food was. Nobody had any idea what Malaysian food was. So I would make a shrimp sambal dish and it looked like it came from Mars because no one had ever experienced it. So he knew that there was something to that. It was something that nobody else was doing at the time. But I didn't know what do food meant. And it took a few years. And one day he said, look, there's this guy who writes a column in the New York Press. It was a newspaper called the New York Press. It was sort of like the Village Voice, but a different version of the Village Voice. And it was in print in New York for many, many years. And this guy, Josh Bernstein, wrote a column there, a weekly column, that talked about him taking people on food adventures. So he would do really cool things like say, hey, meet me on your bicycle at the 125th Street train station and I'll take you to a barbecue. And he would lead 20 people on their bikes up to the Bronx to an abandoned church where a guy was barbecuing in the backyard. And so my husband thought, you know, if that guy was interested enough and adventurous enough to do that, for sure he would come and eat with us. So I sent him an email and I said, hi, Josh, I'm a Malaysian woman. I learned how to cook in my mom's kitchen. I have no other culinary experience, but I want to do food and I don't know what that means. And I thought he would never write back to me. I mean, what kind of email is that? It had no conviction. It had no, you know, it wasn't offering anything. It was just saying, help me. I don't know what I'm doing. And he wrote me right back and he said, call me on Monday. Let's talk about this. So I called him on Monday and he said, how many people can you have in your house for dinner? I said, I think 15. And he said, okay, let's pick a date. You'll send me a menu. Josh is also very much into beer. He said, I'll figure out all the beer and wine pairings. We'll figure out how much to charge. It'll be BYOB and we'll have a dinner. And so we started a supper club in our basement. And every day leading up to the event, he said, hey, I have two friends from out of town. Can they come? And it kept growing and growing. Finally ended up at 21 people. We fed 21 people in the basement. And I was so nervous because even though I had cooked for people my whole entire life, I had never asked them to pay me for it, you know?
Why did that change the way that you approached it? Why did getting paid for it make it feel different?
Because now it felt different because it wasn't just me cooking for friends and family and people who love you already and will say that what you made was good. It was people who are paying. And I think when you pay for something, you have an expectation, right? That it's going to be of a certain level. But we had such a great time.
Do you remember what you cooked for that first meal?
Yes. Okay. So we had ghee rice, which is my mom's recipe that she's made not as an everyday thing for us, but on special occasions. She would make this very interesting ghee rice. We had shrimp sambal, which is a dish I cooked last night for friends. And then we had a cucumber salad that has a yogurt dressing. Also my mom's, they were all my mom's things that she cooked all the time. And a dal, a very light Malaysian-style dal with a really interesting ghee, mustard seeds. And you know what I'm talking about, Ethan. It's like a tadka that you put on top of that. And those things went very well together as a meal. Let's see. And then for dessert, I made something called lapat pisang, which is basically a banana pudding that is folded into banana leaves and then steamed.
Wow.
And those things, you know,
yeah.
That dessert was something that nobody had ever experienced before. And we had a great time. And after that, the next day, I remember thinking to myself, I think there's value in what I do. I think there's something to this do food idea. I'm going to stop rolling my eyes and I'm going to start thinking actually what to do with it. So then we did the supper club thing a few times. And I realized the frustration in that was that I could only reach 20 people at a time. This was back in the day, not many people were doing this kind of thing. There were not those kind of venues where you could pop up at a brewery and feed 100 people that night, you know? And so I started doing street fairs. I did the Atlantic Antic. There's a small street fair in my neighborhood called the Flatbush Frolic. I did Bryant Park, and it was a great experience.
And that was likewise selling prepared, ready-to-eat food, right? Not the packaged products that you come out with since then.
Yeah, it was selling prepared foods. And we made beef rendang, which is a slow-cooked beef stew.
Amazing.
In coconut milk with fresh turmeric, galangal, lemongrass, fennel, and cumin, and dried red chilies and fresh bird eye chilies and tons of coconut milk and toasted coconut. And I learned this from my mom. Again, that was a special occasion dish. On special occasions, she would light a fire in the backyard and build a stove around it and put a wok on that and cook it outside.
Wow.
And I couldn't do that in my Brooklyn backyard. Someday I will. Someday we'll do that version. But I would make 40, 50, 80 pounds of beef rendang.
Wow.
And we were trying to figure out how to serve it in a way that it would make sense at a street fair. Because people are walking around. They're not typically sitting down. So my genius husband, who really is the idea guy in my life, he has all the ideas. He's like, putting in a slider. Put the beef rendang in a slider. I quick pickled some cucumbers with turmeric and coriander and red onions. And we put that in the sliders. And we did so well with those.
Yeah, it sounds amazing.
And the other thing that I put in the sliders was chili crab. So in Malaysia and Singapore, chili crab is this really famous dish. But of course, you sit there and you have to pick at the crab. And I got picked crab from Maryland, and I made chili crab, and it's almost like a sloppy Joe, but it's chili crab in it. And that was amazing too. And so we did the street fairs, and again, I had that feeling like, you know, I can only reach X amount of people with this. And so one day, I think it was winter 2012 or 2013, I was craving sambal, a very particular sambal there. Like I said earlier, there are lots of different kinds of sambals in Malaysia and in Southeast Asia. But there's one particular sambal I was craving. It was one that my mom used to make for us and keep in a jar in the fridge that you could take out and use when you were making a sandwich or when you were having some noodles or whatever. So I called my mom and I was like, Ma, how do you make that sambal? And she broke it down for me on the phone. And mom's recipe has no amounts and no teaspoon of this, a teaspoon of that. She says, first you take some red chilies and then you take some fermented shrimp paste. And then, you know, that's how her recipe was. And I made a jar of it and it came out really good. And it was a 12-ounce peanut butter jar, which to me was a giant jar of sambal. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to eat this for 6 weeks. And my husband got one whiff of it and it was over. It was gone in like 4 days.
He just ate it with a spoon straight from the jar.
Right. And I said to him, you know what? You know what? It's a condiment. It's not like the main dish, okay? And then I realized, you know what? I have to make a lot more sambal. And then it dawned on me, I have to make a lot more sambal. Right. Because if he's from Massachusetts, born and raised here. If he could get behind that fermented shrimp paste, which that's a whole nother story. I've cooked with fermented shrimp paste here in the U.S. and people go running out of their houses because it smells really, what's the word? I don't want to say it smells bad.
Strong, because, maybe? It smells strong.
Right. It's really pungent. It's like, just think of blue cheese times 1,000.
Yeah.
It has been described to me as a rotting corpse or stinky feet. Or a mound of dirty socks. And it's been described in all those ways to me. So I didn't think he would get behind the red sambal the way he did. And I thought, you know what? If he could come to appreciate it, I think other people could too. And so I set out bravely or maybe foolishly to make a product that didn't exist here. And in the time that I've been making it, I found there are people who love the fermented shrimp paste and the pungency and the umami and the seafoodness of it. And there are people who don't, which to me is the same with stinky cheese. Some people love it. Some people just can't deal with it, right?
It sounds like what you're saying is some people have good taste and some people have no taste.
You know what, Ethan? I've learned not to say that.
All right, I'm allowed to say it because I'm not talking about your product. I'm just speaking in general. Some people know what they're talking about when it comes to strong, intense, interesting flavors, and some people are missing out.
Yes. So in the early days of me making sambal, I would generally try and test the waters with someone to see if I could dare to introduce them to my sambal, right? So the first question I would ask them is, do you like anchovies? And if somebody likes anchovies, I think I have a good chance with them. If they don't like anchovies, I'm backpedaling. I'm like, all right, let me go somewhere else because this is not going to work. And I've had that experience sharing sambal here in this country. But I will say that was in 2013. And here we are in 2020. It's a different time. More and more people, and what I think it is everybody's palate is opening up. It's opening up to the experience of international foods, right? And the more and more people experience my stuff or stuff that comes from Africa that is flavored with, didn't you guys say something about a seasoning that is made with locusts?
Yeah, we had we're getting iru, which is a Nigerian or West African fermented locust bean. Yeah.
Right. Yes, and it's the fermentation, and then it's the what is being fermented. And those flavors put together, the flavors are highly, highly concentrated. And now that people are starting to experience these flavors, their palates are getting more adventurous. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
So in 2020, selling sambal is a much different experience than selling sambal in 2013. Boy, do I have some horror stories about demoing this product at stores.
Just to sort of go back to the expertise or the experience that you brought with you from your previous career in music, have you found that there are overlaps between the work that you used to do and the work that you do now? Or if not sort of in the day-to-day of it, are there connections that you found between making music and making food?
Okay, yes. So I always thought that cooking is the same process as writing a song or writing a piece of music. It comes from the same place in your brain. And I've actually had dreams where I'm dreaming that I'm in the kitchen cooking and I'm adding this and I'm adding that and whatever. And the end result is a piece of music.
If you were going to set your sambal to music, what does the sambal song sound like?
It's definitely not Lil Wayne. and it's definitely, I should stop naming names. Why am I doing that? I didn't want to do that. I think it's Motown. It's music from the Motown era, which I love dearly. It might sound like Stevie Wonder on the clavinet. Do you know, remember Stevie playing that clavinet? It was rhythm and chords and harmonies all in one thing. Stevie did not need much help. Yeah. Sounding amazing. That's what sambal would sound like, I think.
I love it. That's so good. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
This episode is brought to you by Uptown Beer Society. They're a craft beer gang dedicated to making memorable collaborations with New York City brands and breweries owned by people of color. Their Bronx Culture series featured three beers made in collaboration with Gun Hill Brewery, inspired by the Bronx and Latinx culture. Uptown Beer Society works with underrepresented brewers and beer bar owners to highlight and celebrate cultural gems that make New York City so special. Learn more about their unique beers and where to find them when you follow them on Instagram at Uptown Beer Society.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food with Arya Abraham, chef and founder of Arya's Malaysian Kitchen. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the connection between your previous career in music and your current career making sambal. I want to go into that a little bit more and talk about other connections that you've found. Were there certain skills that you developed working in music that you've been able to apply in surprising ways now?
I think that some of what I carry over from my past career into my new career is interpersonal relationships and how I handle the people that we deal with on a daily basis, whether it's people who we serve, like buyers and customers, or it's people who serve us, vendors, people that we source from. I think that being in New York in the mid-90s, working with huge ad agencies, clients with very, very demanding clients, and I learned a lot about how a project starts and comes together. At some point, it always looks like it's going to fall apart, and you just keep pushing through with grace, with a smile on your face, and always with utmost respect for everyone that you're dealing with. And with those sort of parameters that you work within for how you treat people and what you expect of yourself, at the end of the day, there's always a good outcome. And if there isn't, you find a way to turn that into a victory, which is you learn from that experience. Right? Am I going on too much?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think one of the points that I've found is that, I mean, not having worked in music professionally, but having been an amateur musician basically my whole life, there's a collaboration element that I really appreciate in right. food and in music. You're cooking in a kitchen, you're cooking with other people, you're cooking for other people, and likewise playing music with other people for other people. There's so many other minds and creative visions often involved in those processes, and I guess in ideally, what comes out at the end is something better than any of the individuals could have produced on their own.
Right. And that's exactly how I like to cook, in a kitchen with other people. And then you're in the kitchen cooking with maybe two other people, three other people, four, who can all cook and who all bring something amazing and unique to the kitchen. And then the meal that comes from that is something you can't do on your own. In a vacuum, it is a magical meal that comes together because everybody has something to bring to the table. And I think that's a huge metaphor in life in general, right? Everybody has different strengths. Not everybody is good at math. Not everybody is good at negotiating. Not everybody is good at putting a recipe together. But if you take this person's strength and that one, you put it together, you have something amazing. You can build something that has reach, right?
Yeah. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the commercialization aspect of it in that regard, that in music and in food, there are things that we want to create that we love for ourselves, but that may not appeal to a broader audience or just require a little bit of adjustment to appeal to a broader audience. How have you navigated that, both in music and in food?
So in music, right, there was no illusions that we were artists. Okay, I know that sounds terrible, but it's true. We had a job, we had clients. I like to think of the difference between Van Gogh and some house painters. So your house painter, you come in, the paint, the color is picked out, here's the wall, you put the paint on the wall, and you do a good job. Nobody's asking you to be creative about it. Nobody's asking you to be extra about it. And what we did in the jingle world was somewhere in between the Van Gogh and the house painter. Okay, now when it comes to food, I decided, for me at least, for Aureus Malaysian Kitchen, that I was never going to compromise my idea of Malaysian food, my familiarity with it, growing up eating everything in Malaysia my whole life before I got here. So when I first put out the red sambal, a client of mine said, "Oh man, my dad loves spicy stuff. I'm going to send him some of your jars." So he bought two jars of red sambal online and we sent it down to Baltimore to his dad. And his dad hated it. He hated it because it was too spicy. That was too much flavor. Too spicy, actually. And he asked my client, his son, for my email address. And he wrote me this long email about why this product would never survive in this country. He said, take it from me. If you want to do anything with this, you are going to have to tailor it to the taste buds of people here. And I read, and it was a long email, and it was really jarring because he was not rude, but he did describe his gastrointestinal distress and his toilet situation the day after he ate my sambal.
What a difficult email that must have been for you to receive, something that you had poured so much of yourself into when you made it, and then to have somebody...
Even I cried.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, so I cried. And then, and I didn't even tell Jeremy, I didn't tell my husband, because I was like, I'm just going to hold it close to my heart and deal with it. And 48 hours later, I decided, you know what? I'm going to learn from this. And what I'm going to learn from this is there are going to be people who are my people, and there are going to be people who are not my people. And that's okay. I don't have to tone it down, not just tone it down, but I don't have to tailor it to try and reach a broader audience, because then what I'm losing is myself. I'm losing myself. Why? Just to reach people who wouldn't otherwise understand me? I don't need those people anyway. I don't want them.
Yeah.
The only person that I have to deal with on a daily basis is myself, right?
Yep.
So I wrote him back. I apologized, and I said, thank you for, this is also a lesson in being a food purveyor or food manufacturer, right? In how to, and dealing with your clients. I thanked him and I said, I'm going to think about what he said. Thank you so much. And that was it. I didn't say I'm going to change it. I'm going to blah, blah, blah. And I didn't change anything. And here we are back then.
Yeah. You get the last laugh.
Right. Right.
I think that's such an important lesson, and one that I think most food entrepreneurs have to learn at some point, is that there are how many hundreds of millions of people in the United States, whatever you make, even if it's a chocolate bar, it's not going to be for everybody.
That's right.
And so then it's a question not of trying to please everybody, but knowing what your vision is and sticking to that and taking feedback, right? Not to ignore people when they give you feedback, to work with feedback within your framework rather than trying to fit your product into somebody else's.
Right. That's right. That's right.
I'm also curious. I mean, one of the things that is so fascinating to me, at least, about Malaysian cooking is just the breadth of it, the number of ingredients, the number of traditions that have fed into Malaysian cuisines, the ways that all of those traditions have interacted over time.
Yes.
Could you give us just a little bit of background on what is, maybe this is an impossibly big question to answer, but what is Malaysian cuisine?
I love answering that question, because for many, 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 many years, nobody knew what Malaysian cuisine was. And I think now in the bigger cities, practically every big city in the US, you can find a Malaysian restaurant, you can experience the food. Here's what Malaysian cuisine is. When somebody says, what is Malaysian food? They say, is it Chinese food? I say, yes. And they go, is it Thai food? Kind of, but it's not. What it is it's an amalgam of the cooking traditions, ingredients, and techniques of three of the largest populations in Asia. So in the 1600s, in the 1500s, the Malays came to Malaysia from Indonesia. They were primarily people from the coastal regions of Indonesia. They came to Malaysia and lived in Malaysia. They farmed the land, and they were fishermen, and they grew rice and herbs, and that was primarily their diet. Later on in the 1600s, 1700s, Chinese were coming from mainland China to Malaysia because there was a lot of mining, tin and copper, and there was a lot of trade to be done in Malaysia. In the 1800s, the British were growing rubber plantations in Malaysia, and they needed people to work the rubber plantations for them. And so they went back to India, which they had colonized before they colonized Malaysia, and brought Indians, because most Indian people then, and even now, already spoke English. So it was easy for them to deal with us and have us work in their plantations. So that's how my two sets of grandparents came to Malaysia in the 1920s, right? And the food is a combination of all those cultures. So we have all the spices and cooking techniques from India. You have all the breadth and depth of Chinese culinary traditions, which is enormous in Malaysia. And you have what the Malays, who back then were Indonesians, brought with them. Put all that together and then add the food and cooking techniques and traditions of our colonizers, who were Portuguese, Dutch, and then British. And that's what Malaysian food is.
Yeah, and not to mention just the incredible breadth of ingredients that are available, right, that right, grow in the ocean, right, and on land, and the geographical diversity of the country, right, too.
Yeah, so I've heard it said that Malaysia is all of Asia on one plate.
Yeah. Is there sort of one dish or one meal that you feel like encapsulates that? If somebody was going to go to a Malaysian restaurant for the first time, what should they order?
Laksa.
What's laksa?
So laksa is a curry noodle dish. It's yellow noodles and rice noodles, two types of noodles in one bowl, in a mild coconut curry broth, topped with, you can put anything on it. I usually put mussels and shredded chicken, and you have tofu and fish tofu, fish balls, bean sprouts, flowering chives. And to me, that is really a quintessential Asian dish, Malaysian dish, because you have the noodle culture from China, you have the curry culture from India, and you have the Malays have a great tradition of foraging for herbs and aromatics, all kinds of little green leaves and shoots and things that are super, super flavorful. Chop those up, throw them on top of a bowl of laksa. Now, I'm not sure that in the U.S. you will get that exact experience, but it's close. It's, yeah, close. Yeah. Right, well, now, I mean, here in the U.S., you'll probably get a mint, like Vietnamese mint on top of it, you know?
So to that point, I want to ask about authenticity. And this is a complicated word, often a challenging word, especially for a food entrepreneur presenting something from their childhood, from their background to a broader audience. So what does authenticity mean for you, and how do you incorporate it or not into your products?
Okay, so authenticity in food is a very complicated subject, right? Because, and it's a great jumping point. Laksa is a great jumping off point for this conversation, because I grew up in a really small town called Seremban, which is about an hour south of the capital, Kuala Lumpur. And in our town, somewhere in the back of town, behind the railroad station or something, there was a laksa vendor that my family and I loved. And we would go and have her laksa maybe once a month, every month. And to me, since I grew up eating that, that's authentic laksa. But if you go to other regions of Malaysia, they have their own versions. I think in Malaysia, there must be 80 different kinds of laksa. So as a Malaysian woman coming to the U.S., when I cook a laksa dish, it's authentic to my experience growing up in Malaysia, in Seremban particularly. So what happens is you talk about a dish and I'm presenting it from my perspective, and I call it authentic. Someone else from Malaysia might think it's not that authentic to them. I guess the end goal is to accept that as long as it's coming from someone who grew up there, who has tons of experience with it, we have to accept a broader definition of authentic when it comes to food. Except if someone, I don't know if I can say this, but except if someone who has very limited experience with it tries to teach you how to make it, then can I say that?
You can say anything you want. Absolutely. We can leave it right there and people can draw their own conclusions from it.
Yeah. Okay.
So in the last few minutes of our conversation, I want to do our rapid fire segment and ask you some quick fun questions. What is your favorite of the products that you make? Which one is your favorite and why?
You know, it's the red sambal. It's the hot chili sambal. It's the spiciest of the, it's the spicier of the two sambals that I make. It's red chili peppers, fermented shrimp paste, which is a very Southeast Asian experience. It's like fish sauce times 1,000. I'm trying to explain how pungent it is. That's how pungent it is. I eat it on bread. I eat it on eggs. I eat it on pizza. I cook with it. To me, it gives me that heat level that I crave. And growing up in Malaysia, if you didn't eat something spicy every day, perhaps you were dead. So I really need that level of heat. And so that one's my favorite baby.
Which recipe was the hardest to get right?
The hardest to get right is the green sambal, the lime leaf sambal. The lime leaf sambal is our best seller and sells, I don't even need to push it. It just goes because it's very friendly. It plays nice with all the other ingredients in your pantry. But it's a very, very finicky process because when you're dealing with green peppers, if you cook it too long, too high, too anything, it turns brown. And then I have made multiple batches of that product that we've had to throw out because the product ends up being brown and it looks terrible. Even though it still tastes good, it looks terrible in the jar and you can't sell it. So that was the hardest one to get right.
Yeah. What's your favorite kitchen tool? What's the tool that you find yourself reaching for most often?
Oh, boy. Well, I have a mortar and pestle. I have two of them. And back home in Malaysia, that's all we used. There was no such thing as a blender when I was a little girl in my mom's kitchen. But right now I think my Vitamix is my favorite tool. Especially when you're making all those really complicated spice pastes for curries and for laksa and for rendang. I mean, I'm not going to stand there and use a mortar and pestle now. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Oh, and there's another thing I recently found. It's a little knife with 5 blades, and it shreds things like scallions and things to make nice garnishes. I just got that. It's brand new, and it's a lot of fun.
Wow, cool. What did you eat for breakfast or for lunch as a kid growing up?
Oh, my God. Okay, our breakfasts were kind of interesting. We had fresh milk delivered every morning. A guy would come from a farm nearby on a motorcycle, like little tiny motorcycle, and he would drop off a bottle of milk. And the bottles, you know what bottles they used? You know those Johnny Walker square whiskey bottles?
Yeah.
They collected those, and that's what they delivered the milk in.
So it had a nice extra flavor on top of it.
No. So my mom would pour the milk in a saucepan and heat it up just until it just put off a little steam, and she would turn it off and she would pour 3 mugs of that, and we had to drink that every day. And there was a layer of cream on top, and that was just absolute pure heaven. That and oatmeal was usually breakfast, and on the weekends we had eggs and we had toast with kaya, which is the other two products that I make, which is a coconut jam.
Yeah, let's talk briefly about that because I want to make sure. It's to me at least seems like it's even less well known in the US than sambal. Such an incredible ingredient and such an interesting wide array of uses. So tell us about kaya.
Yes, and now you are totally right about that. Now sambal seems to, like, everybody knows sambal. It used to be a time when it was cool if you knew what sambal was. Now practically everybody knows what it is. But kaya, yes, it's a coconut jam. It's made with coconut milk, eggs, and sugar. And then it's flavored with pandan, which is a grass that's about hip high from the ground. That is ubiquitous in all Southeast Asian desserts and cooking. And it's flavored and colored with that. Now, back home in Malaysia when we were kids, there was no such thing as Nutella. We didn't have, this is Malaysia in the 70s, okay? There was no Nutella. And fruit preserves and jams and things like that were imported from like Australia or the UK, and they were pricey. They were expensive. So kaya was what we put on toast in the morning. And sometimes at tea time in the evening, we put that's what we put on toast. And so I was here, sitting here in Brooklyn and thinking, you know, I really miss that. The next time I go home, I'm going to learn how to make it. So we go home to Malaysia. My mom's best friend, besties, they're both in their 80s now. They're so cute. Auntie Kim. Auntie Kim and mom spent a lot of time in kitchens together, just cooking and hanging out and being moms. Auntie Kim used to make kaya when we were little. So I said to her, Auntie Kim, I need to learn how to make kaya. And she was so excited, loved having a project. She showed up the next day with the eggs and the coconut milk and the her double boiler and spent the whole morning teaching me how to make kaya. And I'm so happy to be making it. And maybe now I'm a masochist because I like making products and trying to sell them things that no one ever heard of before. And when I talk about them, their brows furrow and they go, what is that? And why do I want that? And I like converting those people.
Yeah.
So if you've ever seen someone take their first taste of kaya, it's kind of, I don't know what this is. And I don't know if I'm going to like it. And then they taste it and their eyes change and they go, whoa, this is, you know, where has this been my whole entire life?
Yeah.
And I love having that experience.
I had that experience myself the first time I went to Malaysia and went out for breakfast at some little cafe in Kuala Lumpur. And I don't know if I knew what I was ordering or I don't remember how it arrived on my plate in front of me, but it really was an epiphany, like nothing else I had ever tasted before.
Right. And I love it when people go, whoa, that's good. And I say, don't sound so surprised.
Yeah. Do you have any pieces of advice, any words of wisdom to share with aspiring or early stage food entrepreneurs?
I want to say be fearless, but I can't actually say that because I'm the most fearful person you ever met. That's why I do things so slowly. Everything takes me, you know, if it takes someone else a week to do it, it'll take me a month to do it because I overthink everything and I really take my time. I guess a piece of advice is it's close to your heart and it means something to you. It's worth sharing.
All right. Beautiful. And Arya, where can our listeners find you, follow your work, buy your products?
Okay, so I'm on Instagram, and on Instagram, I'm the Sambal Lady.
That's great.
The Sambal Lady. And the website is auriasmalaysiankitchen.com.
All right, great. And thanks to, I'm sorry. As always, you can reach us on social at YFoodPodcast. You can email us, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can follow Valerie at Foodie in New York on social media. And you can follow me via my spice company at Burlap and Barrel. Thanks to our theme song, the band that wrote our theme song is the Red Crickets. Our theme song is Blind. And thanks to Matt Patterson, our awesome sound engineer. And most of all, Arya, thank you so much for joining me. This has been such a fascinating and wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Ethan. Thanks for having me. What fun.
See you all next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.